The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
We've already removed thousands of people who have arrived at our southern border. We are enforcing our traditional immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code.
The chaos expected at the border after the end of Title 42 has not materialized so far. And Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas credits the Biden administration's new tougher asylum policies and expanded legal pathways to enter the country. But from New York to Chicago to Denver, cities are scrambling to accommodate more migrants as Texas Governor Greg Abbott continues to bus asylum seekers from the southern border to sanctuary cities. New York City Mayor Eric Adams had some harsh words for people criticizing the city's decision to house thousands of migrants in hotels.
So whomever is saying, don't go to a hotel on this block, don't go to a hotel on that block, if you're telling me that, then I need for you to tell me where to go.
My guest is immigration law expert Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. So, Leon, let's start with the end of Title 42. The number of migrants encountered at the southern border fell 50% during the last 3 days. You know, everyone was anticipating that there would be a surge at the border.
I think for a lot of people, there's a wait-and-see approach that they're operating with, which is that they want to see, A, are there going to be a sufficient number of these CBP-1 appointments on the border that people can use to access the process legally without needing to access the process illegally? B, what's going to happen to people who sort of test the system and put their finger in the plug, so to speak? Are they going to get an electric shock or not? And I think people are waiting to see how people are being treated who cross the border. Are they being thrown into detention? Are they being allowed to be released? And I think as people start to see, to the extent possible, that there's not enough detention space to put everyone in detention, I think you'll see an uptick on the numbers there. And I think people are also trying to see what this thing means that you're not eligible for asylum. And I think they don't really understand it quite yet. But when they figure out what that means is that many years down the road, your court case is going to be harder, but there's not really a bar per se on bringing you into the country. I think you'll see these numbers increase. But for what you're seeing right now for the moment is sort of a feeling out process because people don't really understand the incentive structure and what is the best way to operate within this current incentive structure.
So explain what the Biden plan is or what the enforcement mechanisms in place are.
The Biden plan is trying to provide what's called a carrot and sticks approach. And what it's trying to say, and of course, all of this is subject to litigation, but let's just stay with what their ideal plan would be if nothing was enjoined by the court. Their ideal plan would be on the carrot end. There's two ways to access carrots. Number one is to get an appointment online, to go to a port of entry and ask for asylum at the port of entry. And the reason for that is because if you cross in between the ports illegally, you create much more strain on the system. You have to have Border Patrol people come and get you and put you in a detention facility, and they don't know how many people are coming, and they can't plan for it. Whereas if you access the system legally, we know on any given day there's going to be this many people that come through per day. They're going to be coming in through these ports, and then they can be planned for. So the idea is do that, and you'll be able to access the asylum system if you actually have a credible fear of persecution in your home country. Alternatively, you can apply, at least for so long as it exists, which might be another month or so, or maybe the court will rule that Biden can do this. But for these 30,000 parole slots per month from Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Haiti, and if you apply for those parole slots, then you can actually access the system legally without even needing an asylum claim. You just get into one of the slots and you can come into the United States. Or you can make an asylum claim at one of these new processing centers that's opening up, either in Colombia or in Central America. And in those centers, you can make your claim. And if you have a legitimate asylum claim, you can be brought into the United States as a refugee. You automatically win your case. You don't even need to go into court in that situation. And so those are the ideas. And as opposed to that, if you cross illegally without any announcement or any permission, then what the Biden administration will do is theoretically the threat of deterrent that they're putting is they're saying you won't be able to access the asylum system, which doesn't mean you can't stay. It just means you have a harder evidentiary burden to get this thing called withholding of removal, which doesn't give you a path to citizenship. It just allows you to stay temporarily while the conditions in your country remain dangerous to you. And that's all you're going to be able to get, which means you can't petition for any family members. You won't ever be able to access a green card or be able to get any of the benefits that come with a green card or citizenship. And the question is, how much of a long-term deterrent is that going to be versus if people don't have access to these other carrots, either because they get taken away from the courts or what happens is that there's too few carrots and too many people. They may just say, you know what, the fact that I can just come into America and wait 6 years for a court date is good enough for me. If 6 years later I can't get asylum, we'll deal with that then. And so that's the question. I think everybody's waiting to see how that shakes out on the border for the next few weeks.
So the credible fear interview, does every migrant from, let's say, Haiti, Venezuela, do they all pass the credible fear interview? Because
well, you have to be able to articulate a fear from one of those countries that's based on your race, your religion, your nationality, your social group, or your political opinion. So at least from Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, those currently have repressive governments. So if you articulate anything like, I'm a political dissident, they know me, and they're going to arrest me if I come back because I was participating in X, Y, or Z protest, that's going to be enough to get you through the credible fear screening. For Haiti, it's a little bit tougher because the idea is that the political persecution is not necessarily the problem there. So you'd have to say that there was some gang or rebel paramilitary force or something like that that was trying to persecute you for some reason. And so those are harder claims to make on the Haitian side. But the problem is, on the Haitian side, even if you can't make that claim, there's only so few people that were being allowed to remove to Haiti right now. And so that's an issue of still people potentially being released just because there's not enough flights and slots to remove people to Haiti.
Let's talk about the lawsuits. In Florida, the U.S. is in litigation about whether it can release migrants without what's called a notice to appear. So what they've been doing is just releasing migrants from custody with instructions to report to an immigration office in 60 days. Do they come back?
Well, so we've gone through this June. I don't know if you recall, there's been two Supreme Court cases in the last 2 years, shockingly enough, on the simple issue of whether when you get your notice for your hearing, does it have to have the correct date and time on it? I don't know if you recall.
Yes, no, I definitely do recall it.
And so this issue has gone twice to the Supreme Court, has created a major problem for the people down at the southern border, because how the heck are they supposed to know what the correct date and time should be for a hearing? Because they don't even know where, what cities people are going to end up in. And so it becomes very complicated. So what the Border Patrol has wanted to do is to say, look, don't make this our problem, because we're not good at this. We can't figure out all the court systems and what dates and what times and what cities because half of the folks don't even know where they're going to end up. And so from that perspective, what we want to do is give them an opportunity to get their bearings and then come back and report and get their date and time for their hearing. Now, of course, the problem is how many people are going to do that, get their bearings and voluntarily go to an ICE check-in 60 days later at the city they end up in. I mean, it's a credible point to say that only the best intention of people are going to actually do that. And so it's really a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, because, yes, you can release people with a hearing notice, and that hearing notice 99 out of 100 times is going to be worthless because it's going to be for a city that the people aren't even living in. And one day they're going to be in absentia in the court. They're not going to show up for their hearing. And many years later, they'll be apprehended and tried to be deported. And they'll say, I never got notice of my hearing. I didn't live in Toledo. I lived in Chicago. Why did they assign me for Toledo? So the point is, it's really about what is most effective to get people through the system. And Florida has taken the position, at least give people a hearing date and a notice. And ICE is saying, this is taking us too long. People are in detention cells, huge overcrowded cells with 50 people in one toilet while we're trying to figure this out. And it's not really, in the end, any more effective at creating deterrence than having the people show up to the ICE situations. Because if these notices are useless, then they're just as useless as people not showing up to the ICE check-in. And so this is the tension on both sides of the argument.
So, Leon, tell us what the judge did in that Florida case.
What the Florida judge did is said, look, I recognize all of the practical and logistical concerns that you're saying, but at the end of the day, I cannot let you release people without giving them, the law says what the law says. When the attorney general, is what it says in the statute, but now it's really the Secretary of Homeland Security, encounters a person without status, they must detain the person. The statute says must detain the person and place them in removal proceedings. And then after that can make a decision about releasing them while the proceedings are pending. But they can't just ignore the person who's in undocumented status or parole the person in undocumented status. Here's the question. That's going to be the one that goes to the Supreme Court, is can they parole the person? The Supreme Court hasn't said. The federal government thinks they can. This judge thinks that that's arbitrary and capricious, that you can't use parole as a way to en masse circumvent the requirement that's in the statute that when the government encounters an undocumented person, they have to detain them and place them in removal proceedings. You know, you could do parole on an individual case-by-case basis, but when you do a whole system that's designed to circumvent this requirement, that that's arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedure Act. So you can't do that. You can't just have an entire workaround for administrative convenience. And so that's what the judge in Florida said. The judge was going to stay his own decision, but didn't in the end. Now has kept it going. The 11th Circuit hasn't overturned it yet. So for the moment, the Biden administration is going to have to, when it detains these individuals, keep them in the CBP holding cells until it can figure out what time and date to put on the hearing notice, to give them the hearing notice, to have them go on to the next step of the process, which is the removal proceeding process.
The ACLU is trying to block Homeland Security from implementing Biden's policy, saying it closely resembles a Trump administration's policy that a court blocked.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
This is a very fascinating issue between two statutes that are both legal and both conflict with one another. So what statute wins? So here are the two arguments. And this is the same argument in the Trump administration, and we didn't get to the Supreme Court, so we don't know. So here are the two arguments. On one aspect of the asylum statute, it very clearly says that anybody in the U.S., no matter how they got here, can apply for asylum. And so the idea is, because the statute specifically says that, the ACLU is saying you can't ban someone from accessing the asylum system because they came here in between the ports of entry illegally. The whole point is the statute specifically says that they can do that. And so why would you ban that? And then there's another part of the statute that says, here are all the reasons you can be banned from getting asylum. And it lays out that you committed a significant crime, that you persecuted other people. There's a whole list. But then there's a catch-all that says the Secretary of Homeland Security can add, by regulation, additional factors. And so the question is, can this factor be added as an additional factor, or can it not be added as an additional factor banning people from asylum? And that's really the question at the end of the day.
I want to talk about the situation in New York. New York Mayor Adams bashed the White House and congressional Republicans early this month over the situation, saying that it shouldn't be the cities that have to deal with this. The federal government should be intervening to help.
I mean, the problem is the confluence of factors that have very little here to do with the federal government. You have states paying for people to take buses to New York City and other cities. So then people arrive at the bus stations. And then the question is, if people do not have a home in New York City, what do you do with suddenly 75 people who just arrived at a bus station who have nowhere to go and no money? And so that's the challenge. And so from the New York City perspective, they have two places they can go. They can either house people until they figure out plan B, or they can create a much more robust logistical network to figure out where the final destinations of these individuals was, because very few people don't have some place, somebody who told them, when you get to America, contact this person. And then they'd have to pay for the transportation logistics to get the person to that location. Now, people may say, well, that's expensive, getting a person yet another flight or a bus or something else. But it's far more expensive to house people for weeks and weeks at hotels. So I think if the Adams administration wants to get out from under housing people, then the way to do this is to have a very robust transportation logistics framework immediately, where people, the second they get off the bus, are basically asked, where is the address you're trying to get to? And get people as close to that address as possible. I mean, you don't have to take people door to door, but get people closer to those locations, whether it be by bus or train or airplane, and at least that way you're not paying for housing in that situation. If you built with city employees, basically what the equivalent would be of some sort of rapid response travel task force that would get the logistics of where the people wanted to go, and you would say, look, there's no way you came into the United States with literally zero people that you know. You have to know somebody. And in fact, everybody knows who's coming to the United States that one of the factors in whether you will stay in detention or not is if you don't have an address of a place where you say you're going to go. So almost everybody knows they have to have an address of some contact person. And so the question is, what is that contact address that's been given? Get people to that contact address.
So in order to be let out of detention, you have to have an address? So the people who are being bussed up actually have an address?
They have an address that they've given to the federal government as the contact address where they're going to be able to have mail sent to them, at least theoretically at the beginning of this, until they theoretically file a change of address. Now, how many people do that is a question that's up for debate, because the stats are very difficult to keep on these things. You don't know until, you know, someone doesn't show up to court. That's when you find out they didn't file the change of address. So it's hard to know exactly with the statistics how many people are filing them or not filing them. But there is an address that people are giving to get out from under detention. And so the question is, if you're giving an address, then you should have to be prepared to be transported to that address.
So why can't the federal government then transport the migrants to the states where they have the address?
Well, I think what's happening is that they're being short-circuited by Texas and maybe now Florida, who's actually just putting people on buses, just to put them on buses. And so it's creating a distortion from where people should be going. But how do you deal with that? And so either the federal government's going to have to get much more involved in the logistics of this so as to not let Texas and Florida and others put people on buses, or these cities are going to have to themselves get involved in the transportation logistics of this. You know, there are some issues in the immigration sphere where all of your solutions are bad. So I'll give you an example of this. Everybody who talks about, well, the way you solve the immigration problem is, you know, attack the root causes of immigration. People keep saying this. Every time I've talked to you, June, for the last few years, I said the same thing to you, which is, how do you do that? There's like 20 countries sending people right now. What does that even mean? You know, attack the root causes. From that standpoint, that's nonsense. That's an unsolvable problem that people are sending people here. But it's definitely a solvable problem that people are showing up to New York City and have nowhere to go. So the question is, do you solve that at the Texas border or do you solve that somewhere else? That's going to be up to the federal government working with these cities to figure out who they want to be responsible for getting people to the address that they said was their address. I mean, what the federal government appears to have done is to up the FEMA emergency shelter grants to the cities by $300 million, which leads me to believe that they want the cities solving it on their end rather than having the federal government get involved in this.
As always, it's a pleasure to have you on, Leon. Thanks so much. That's Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland &
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Night. In a case that could help determine which party controls the House over the next decade, the Supreme Court will consider reinstating a Republican-drawn congressional map in South Carolina. The justices said they'd review a lower court ruling that found a coastal district running from Charleston to Hilton Head was intentionally redrawn to reduce the number of black voters and to make it more likely that Republican candidates would win. Joining me is elections law expert Richard Brafault, a professor at Columbia Law School. A federal three-judge panel said the strategies in drawing this South Carolina district's boundaries had unconstitutionally exiled 30,000 black voters. Tell us what the federal panel found.
Well, basically that. This is part of the 2022 redistricting in South Carolina. The district involved is basically the one around the Charleston area. And the court found that a panel in the legislature had redrawn the lines so as to remove about 30,000 black voters from the district and put them in an adjacent district, which would have the effect also of basically making it a more Republican district.
Tell us the history of this district. It's consistently elected Republicans for almost four decades.
But a Democrat won in 2018, and then Republicans took it back in 2020, but by a very narrow margin. So I think one of the ideas here was to make it more safely Republican.
The NAACP said a person can't drive from one end of the coastal district to another without going through the neighboring 6th district.
Well, the way the lines are drawn is that, in fact, they were like tentacles from that kind of project from one of the adjacent districts into this district. And so it was a departure from the traditional boundaries of this district, although the district, I think, presumably satisfies the standard requirements of it being contiguous. You presume you can go from one part to any other part of the district, but it could also be that in order, the easier way to go from one part to the other is to go through the neighboring district.
Oftentimes, when they draw districts, I mean, you don't see, like, oh, a square or a circle. You see some really crazy shapes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, given that the strangeness of the shapes that we see, I'm not sure this one would necessarily qualify as one of the most bizarre or strangely shaped. But the argument that the plaintiffs made, which the court agreed with, was that it was purposefully drawn to remove black voters. And that is what the court found. And the plaintiffs basically said if you ran alternative map simulations as a standard technique today in dealing with districting claims, is to generate alternative maps that satisfy the other legal requirements of contiguity, of equal population, of maintaining neighborhoods intact, that running a string of like 1,000 alternative maps, this one removed more black voters than any other map.
So the South Carolina Republicans said the panel made a series of legal errors, and it said Republicans were motivated by politics, which is permissible, not race.
Yes, that is the irony in the last decade's worth of redistricting fights, particularly but not exclusively in the southern districts. The Supreme Court has said that racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional, but partisan gerrymandering is constitutional, or at least it can't be challenged in court. Yet race and party are very closely intertwined. And so in many of the redistricting cases, particularly those coming out of the South, where you've seen Republican legislatures moving black voters out of districts in order to make them more Republican, but their argument has been, well, it wasn't because of their race, it was because of their party. So that this was partisan gerrymandering, which is okay, but not racial gerrymandering, which is not okay, even though it's very hard to tell the two apart.
Yeah, the challengers in the brief said the predominant reliance on race is impermissible, even if mapmakers used race as a proxy for politics.
And that has been the finding of several other lower courts. So that is a legitimate argument. The South Carolina legislature is sort of pushing back and saying, well, you didn't give us credit for good faith. You're supposed to basically accept what the legislature does unless you can prove that it was done with racial intent. And the plaintiffs were basically saying, well, look at the numbers, look at the effects, and look at the existence of alternative maps. So this will be yet another challenge for the court to try and disentangle racial motivation from partisan motivation, which is really the problem they've set up for themselves by saying that racially motivated districting is unconstitutional, but partisan districting is not challengeable, and yet the two are often identical.
How does one prove that districting was racially motivated?
Well, what the plaintiffs did in this case is basically run alternative maps. I mean, that is another standard form of litigation now because of the availability of high-powered computers with massive amounts of data, is that you can basically put in an algorithm which says equal population, maintaining communities of interest, maintaining the contiguity of the district, and run like 1,000 other maps. And they say they did that, and this one actually, what the legislature did, removed more black voters than any other or almost any other map that you could show. And so therefore, what was going on here was the removal of black voters.
The three-judge panel did reject challenges to two other House voting districts,
right,
saying that the civil rights groups had failed to demonstrate that the districts had been predominantly drawn to dilute black voting power. Does that help the challenger's case any?
It might. I mean, it basically shows that the three-judge court was not a rubber stamp for the plaintiffs and that they kind of carefully went through the evidence and said, well, what happened in the other districts was not extreme enough to prove racial motivation. But in this district, it was so clear that we found it. I think it actually is helpful to the plaintiffs.
Does it seem as if the Supreme Court took this case to reverse the federal panel?
It's hard to say. I think under federal election law, the court basically has mandatory jurisdiction over appeals of federal courts knocking out districting. Now, they could affirm summarily, and they did not do that. So they may be interested in this case. But cases like this often go to the Supreme Court. And it'll be a challenge, I think, to figure out the distinction between race and party in a world or in a politics where the two are often merged.
If partisan gerrymandering is allowed, then the group that's in power can consistently revise maps so that they keep their power.
That is a very legitimate and troubling concern. And that was one of the main arguments in favor or supporting the idea of judicial review of partisan gerrymandering, as otherwise you get a lockup. And once a group gets elected to office, they're able to sustain themselves by manipulating the boundaries. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court was not persuaded by that argument in the Rucho decision in 2019. The Supreme Court basically said, we don't have a standard for reviewing districting that allows us to tell what's a permissible use of party and what's an unconstitutional one, and so we're not going to do it. That was the court's reasoning in that case.
But there's another case involving redistricting and race.
In Alabama, yes. That's slightly different. Indeed, it's almost, I wouldn't say it's reversed, but it's slightly different. There, the legislature drew lines. There, the perspective is on Alabama as a whole. So this case about South Carolina focuses on one district. This focuses on District 1 in South Carolina. In Alabama, the focus was on the state as a whole. And the state is something like, 27-28% African-American. There are seven congressional districts. Only one has had a black majority. The plaintiff said that you could easily have drawn two, and they basically came up with a map that showed that, and they were able to persuade the lower court. That's being challenged by the legislature, which says you didn't show that our failure to draw two districts was racially motivated. The plaintiff's claim is based under the Voting Rights Act, which really relies on effects rather than intent. And in the Alabama case, what the legislature is defending by saying is that there was no evidence that what we did was racially motivated. The plaintiffs are saying that's not important. What we can do is show that there was an equal population, contiguous district, which, you know, doesn't too much depart from county lines, although admittedly it's different from the prior districts that have been drawn in this state, but which we think would give better representation to black voters.
Explain how the Supreme Court has been rolling back protections for minority voters.
Well, the Supreme Court did one major thing, which is the Supreme Court struck down the provision in the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was renewed several times over, including in 2006, which requires that in certain states and counties which have had a history of voting discrimination, that any changes in their voting rules and their voting practices and procedures have to be pre-approved by either the Department of Justice or a federal district court, and the state or community that's making the change has to prove it has no discriminatory intent or effect. That was called preclearance, and that operated to prevent a lot of discriminatory measures, particularly but not only in the South. The Supreme Court struck that down in 2014, saying that the problem was that Congress continued to adhere to the formula for deciding what was a community that had to go through preclearance, and that formula hadn't been reviewed and reconsidered since the 1970s. So the court said it just can't be right, that it's still the same formula. So that was a major blow. That eliminated the ability of plaintiffs to challenge changes before they took effect and to put the burden of defending the changes on the state or city making the change. So that was a very important decision, and one that I think it's made it much harder for plaintiffs in voting rights cases to win. The other case, a case coming out of Arizona about 2 years ago called Brnovich, was less of a rollback but more of a creation of barriers to challenging voting laws that make it harder for people to actually cast a vote. What was going on in the Section 5 case, the preclearance case, was essentially about districting, which is also what this case is about. The case is both in Alabama and South Carolina. But in recent years, we've seen a lot of states adopting rules that make it harder to be able to vote, including things dealing, say, with voter ID or rules governing early voting or absentee ballots. And the one question was, you know, under the Voting Rights Act, a claim is often made that these burden voters of color more heavily than white voters. And in the Brnovich case from Arizona, the Supreme Court essentially, we're going to really increase the burden of proof on plaintiffs challenging these rules to show that, in fact, these rules have a discriminatory effect.
And what's the status of Moore v. Harper, the case that was advancing the controversial independent state legislature theory? Do we know yet what's happening with that?
No, the court asked for, as you know, Moore v. Harper was the case that raised the so-called independent state legislature theory, which is the idea that some people have argued is that when it comes to federal redistricting, congressional redistricting, only state legislatures can do it because of some language in the Constitution which implies that, as opposed to state courts interpreting state constitutions to prohibit partisan gerrymandering, even in congressional elections. And in that case, the North Carolina Supreme Court struck down the congressional districting plan for North Carolina, finding that it was a partisan Republican gerrymander. The North Carolina legislature challenged that, saying North Carolina Supreme Court didn't have the authority under the North Carolina Constitution, that this is a matter solely for the legislature as a matter of the U.S. Constitution. Supreme Court agreed to hear that case and actually heard oral argument for like 2.5 hours back in the fall. Supreme Court hasn't decided this case yet. In the meantime, as a result of the 2022 elections, the composition of the North Carolina Supreme Court changed hands, and the court very recently basically reversed its decision and said that the legislature's plan is not a gerrymander under the North Carolina Constitution, that the North Carolina Constitution does not prohibit gerrymanders. So the U.S. Supreme Court asked for a briefing on the question of whether they still have jurisdiction, whether they should go ahead and decide this case or not. But I think those briefs were submitted only recently. Well, I imagine we'll get a decision one way or the other. Either the court will say we don't have jurisdiction, dismissing the case, or the court will hold on to the case and decide it. But we may not know until the end of June, possibly.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Rich. That's Professor Richard Prefault of Columbia Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.